Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the Kit Kat Club is proud to present something new, something different. Right. Will you please give a warm welcome for the rhythm, rhythm, rhythm.
Right. Well, I came here for something funky to happen. It's just Christmas because everybody's rapping. Prepare to get sparked by the song that I sing. No, my name is Martin Luther, but I'm considered the king. Yo, my beats are pumped by the mic I clamp. I don't need an amplifier. My brain is the amp. I got the beat to make you tingle, make your body mingle. Like you got the fever for the flavor of a Pringle. We got say not so. I'm just like Picasso, a pioneer. I am here. Ask me how I got so fly. And the chance I can give them a new beginning. Stevie-O and my dope rhythm. I felt the Lord and Master give a mental harm. My sole chief belief is that it's wrong. My beat's pump, so let it grab ya. I got a trick, but my name ain't Alibaba. So open sesame, never heard the best of me. Bet you all the people in the place, I bet you the recipe. That it's a new beginning. My name, Kwame. And if you didn't know, I can tell you that I'm a Melaku brother, slicker than oil. Rap gets so hot, it makes the spit boil. The rhythm, rhythm, rhythm. Rapper, the K is more, rhymes like the thunderbolts of the mighty Thor. Be gone with yourself, cause I conquer, boy. I break them seas like a Tonka toy. Smooth, spy, saddlebag, debonair. Come in the party, yeah, I see you stopping there to hear the man who only had your head shook. You dressed too cute to me, you got your cold ass look. Cause I'm a mystical, rapper probably physical. Ask about Kwame, hey, they say he is a cool fella. He's always mellow, he's ever high, strong spark. When the mic is near him, it's clever, I run smooth. Like Moet, recite like a poet. Ain't my rhymes slam? Oh man, I know it. Cause when I'm on the mic, wild boys say, oh golly. Slip on my tip like the hip on poly grip. I go cameo, be on the Grammy show. I be as sleek as a chic out freak anyhow. In the pantyhose, pumping clothes, yo. My rhymes slam? Well, I suppose. Cause I might meander, so a shenanigan. To say a fresh rhyme, yo, you know I can again. Cause I destroyed, bust them like a hemorrhoid. Strong like a steroid, avoid the noise. The rhythm, rhythm, rhythm. Take a rap to the M-A-X. And as I step in the party, that's when they X. For me to get on strong, no fear. Like a gladiator, turn on steam up. MCs like a radiator, play them all out. Execution in style, speak my piece, just release, refusing to smile. Fit serious, though I rap a little humor. But still, MCs, I hear, assume I can never bust a fat rap twice. But at that price, on any mic you gave me, I got nice. I push up, pull up, sit up, get up, and fed up. Shut your lip up, and let's go head up. Poisonous is venom, no mistake, venom. Gucci on silk, you got vodka on denim. No, my name ain't Taco, Emilio or Paco, but Kwame, boy. And I got your chick on the side, caught sweat in my tip. Gave a peck on the neck just to wetten my lip. I don't drop my pants for the raggedy ants, just to pass up a chance on a kid's romance. I should've blow this mic, like I said I might. Got the force of 20 men, like a Jedi Knight. And it's kinda hard for me not to do it slow, so I gotta go, the rhythm.
Welcome everybody to the Headliners Ball. This show's format gives both authors and audience alike the chance to entertain a deeper discussion regarding a choice selection of poems from the author's catalog of work. Headliners will perform pieces in their intended style. In turn, they will receive encouraging feedback from an all-inclusive panel of late-night poet callers. My name is Jeremy F. I'm as excited as ever for tonight because we have wonderful poets that we are going to be spotlighting. But first, I would like to say hello to my beautiful, talented, and always present co-host, Pam Ray. Pam, how are you?
I am doing good. And I tell you, when it comes to ass-kissing Jeremy, you are absolutely fabulous. I love you, man.
I know where my bread is buttered, Pam. Don't you doubt it for 1 minute.
Then you'll be able to listen to the show.
I'm looking forward to hanging out with you, a couple other cool poets, and, you know, just delving into the poetry. It's going to be a great night.
Yeah, I always get excited for Wednesdays because I get to talk to some of my I get to do a little bit of fanning out on some of my favorite poets here at AP. Tonight we have Babbler and Tea Ink Poem. So I'm excited to talk to them both. Are they on the line yet?
Well, here's the thing is I know Babbler's on for sure, and Tea Ink is on twice, so I'm going to see if she says something when we hear her. So
okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. So they're both on with you.
Wonderful, guys. I'm excited. This is going to be a fun night. I think we are going to – Babbler, how are you doing tonight?
Okay. I'm doing all right.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Tank.
Yeah.
Okay.
Babbler, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Still getting over the tail end of COVID. I'll try to mute my cough as best I can. But I'm doing all right otherwise.
Well, I'm glad you're amongst the living because we are excited to dive into your work. And, in fact, we are going to start with you tonight, being that Tink is across the pond and she's still probably trying to work a little bit of crust out of her eyes because it's bright and early Thursday morning where she is. So we'll give her a chance to get her motor running before we start hitting her with the hard questions. So, Babbler, if you are ready, I'm going to go ahead and post your first poem on here and we will dive right into it. Seems I can figure out what I'm doing here. Stillness, Babbler. It is up whenever you're ready.
All right. This is stillness. There are no fish left in my father's little lake, the one he dug out when I was three. There are no fish to draw the birds, no feathers to disturb mirrored sky and set the surface aflutter. It is clear as glass, and I can see to the bottom. The mud I once squished between my toes, fallen cattails decomposing, sunken chips and wayward seashells scattered in the silt. I breathe in and hold it, the smell of frog eggs and fish bait and sunshine, and let him go. End poem.
Great read. Pam, start us off tonight, please, if you will.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. Wonderful read and write, Babbler. And I see this won a silver in one of Kevin's contests, so congratulations on that. I really like how the main message that I get from this is the idea of looking back, you know, and letting go of the past. Now, is this based on truth, like your father actually did dig a lake?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very cool. Yeah, I really like that you not only bring in the imagery, but you bring in the other senses. I breathe in and hold it, the smell of frog eggs and fish bait and sunshine, and let him go. You know, they say that, I've read before that scent is the sense that is strongest connected to memory. And as someone who also spent much of her childhood by a lake, those are very familiar smells, the fish bait, the fish, the kind of the smell of the water itself. And so I thought this was beautifully written and very well done. And one question, now when you write something like this that's so raw and honest, and I know a lot of your poetry does often have a raw and honest truth to it. Do you find yourself able to have a neutral sense of emotion, or do you find yourself reacting emotionally to your own poetry when you write something like this?
You know, this one I did, most of the time I honestly don't, and not because I don't feel things, but like my emotions the best. I think if you were to know me like in person and not through poetry, I'd seem kind of stalwart. I've had people tell me that I seem cold, and it's just because I'm not good at expressing my emotions immediately and in person. Like, I don't have that gut kind of reaction most of the time. And so I remember when I was a kid, I've been through a lot of deaths, having to go, like, talk to the school counselor because, like, my best friend died when I was 16. And, like, my whole school was mourning, and I was not, at least not on the exterior. And I guess that the school was concerned. I call it emotional constipation. Like, I do feel things, but it comes much later. And so I find that I do a better job of expressing how I feel about things when I write about them. So part of why I write, actually.
Very cool. That makes sense. I like it.
Wow. Great insight, Babler. Tank, what are your comments?
Well, I liked the connection between the fish and the water and the feathers and the sky and the way that all of the elements are mentioned, but they're all rather sad because they're all have been moments. And the sunken ships and wayward seashells, I think that's rather wonderful because it's what she could maybe really of looking at, and that could be a metaphor. So I think it's wonderfully subtle and quite sad. And yeah, I like it a lot. And that whole thing about smell is very Proustian. That sort of memory that's brought back in a very pure form. So yes, I like that a lot. And what you were saying about buried emotions, I mean, surely that's almost why poetry can be so effective, because it's a place to put those things. And so if you say you're emotionally constipated, I think it's very almost dangerous to label things like that. This is how you are. It's just, you know, it's how you are in the world, and it's neither good nor bad. It's not constipated. It's just the way you deal with things, and other people do things up front, and a poet uses words, and it comes out in another way, maybe later, maybe immediately, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't mean it in a judgmental way towards myself. I almost mean it in more of a comedic way. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with me. It's just a different reaction to, I think, how most people express themselves.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, great comment, Tank. No, I like that. And I like how you carried on with Pam. And I love that question, Pam, and I love the conversation that it inspired. Because, honestly, Babler, it's funny. Your story was funny because I was the exact same way in high school. I remember we had a death of one of my classmates, and the whole entire class went to a I don't know, a gathering, and I was the only one that did because I was so put off by the whole thing. So I think, and the fact that you use poetry to channel, express, celebrate your emotions is a really cool way to use the medium. I mean, it definitely does shine through. What I liked specifically about this, and I think even Pam hinted on it, was all the motion, all the sensory feelings that you have in the first two stanzas. There's a lot of action and a lot of movement. There's a lot of life in all of it. And you can feel that in the memory, right? The memory of something that was very close to you. So there was a lot happening physically and from the heart. And then you juxtapose that to the fact that it really – the poem is about loss, and that is the underlying strong feeling that you have. And when I was able to digest this poem, I was really taken aback by the title because that sets it off the most. I mean, really, that's what the whole poem is about, is dealing with that stillness and that loss. And so my softball question for the first poem of the night, Babler, is how much weight do you put in titling? I mean, a lot of people do it almost as an afterthought. Do you emphasize a lot of that in your poetry?
So for me, a title, a lot, I usually title something with a single word that I feel is kind of key to the piece. Sometimes it's in the piece, sometimes it's not. Which is kind of the thing here, is this word isn't actually even in here, but it's what the poem is about. Sometimes the word does appear, but a lot of times it doesn't. And then other times it's a phrase. And well, when they're phrases, it's usually me being wry.
And that's fair. That's a fair answer. I mean, some of the greats don't even title their poems at all. So, yeah, I like that. I liked, especially in this instance, that caught me as especially poignant. So I like how you framed that. So, wonderful poem. And the next one, Curiosities of a Cetacean, is up whenever you're ready.
What a nice lead-in. It's a phrase. So this is Curiosities of a Cetacean. Tell me, O teller of tales, about the deepest, darkest desires of whales. Do they dream of dolphins and dirigibles, or perhaps periwinkle porcupine fish with silvered spines for spearing? When they slumber, do they envision the umber under of a wayward cucumber, or a backlogged bullfrog that leapfrogged against the sky? Do they muse or meditate on life on land, of legging or loping or limb? How strange and stringy things we must seem, up here jumping, jogging, jigalog, progging in their sky. What a wondrous wishing to go fishing for the deliberations of a languid leviathan. End poem.
I love this one. You're up, Tank. What do you think?
Oh, well, I just love this one too. Firstly, the title's brilliant because they are. They actually are very, very curious. But the curiosities is a lovely way of putting that. One of my favourite words here, dirigibles. that's just wonderful. The whole thing rattles down with a beautiful sense of fun and really smart rhyming. It's kind of Lear-esque, you know, the poetry of the English nonsense poet, Edward Lear. Yeah, just lovely. Refreshing, actually. Lovely humor.
Great comment, Tink. And I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And the best part about this babbler, I mean, this one had me just giddy, because to be a poet, in my opinion, you have to have a love of language, and to have a love of language expressed so that others can feel that love definitely shines through a poem like this, where you were just dancing across the words. I mean, it really is just a big dish of popcorn happiness of wordplay that I really enjoyed. And the best part that just had me squealing with joy was your author note, the fact that gigalog is not a word. I love that you put a word in there that is your own nonsensical word, and it fits so good, so perfectly in that sentence, jumping, jogging, gigalog, progging. That, I don't know, it's just eye candy. I loved it. It had me giggling, and I enjoyed it 100%. Now, if I remember right, you are known, you told a story during one of your shows one time, Babbler, about how you're known amongst your circle of friends as having a special relationship with vocabulary and language. I think you told me one time that you were at a party and you used the word gargantuan or something like that, and everyone started giggling. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I've been known for being kind of wordy. I kind of attribute it to the fact that I read a lot, and it doesn't seem weird to me because I read all the time. But yeah, I've certainly been the butt of some of my friends' jokes because I'll just use a word that to me doesn't seem large or unwieldy in any kind of way. It seems normal in the context of what I'm saying. But my friends will just stop and look at me like, what did you, like, I just spoke another language. Or in the case of, like, gargantuan, I described something as gargantuan, and they just laughed. I mean, I got made fun of for that for, like, weeks. And I'm like, it's not that odd of a word. Like, I don't feel like it's even that big of a word. And, yeah, this piece is very much me just playing with words. I was just having a good time when I wrote this, just fiddling with how words fit together. So, it's just the fun, right?
Yeah, it definitely shines through. Pam, your thoughts?
Oh, this is wonderful. I just wish that Jeremy had been off mute when he was squealing with delight. I'm sorry we all missed that. But no, this is so much fun, Babbler. Your play with words. You can tell that you had fun with this one. Your sense of humor comes through. I too really liked the fact that you made up a word. And my particular favorite part was, do they envision the umber under of a wayward cucumber or a backlogged bullfrog that leapfrogged against the sky? You take everyday imagery, but you combine it in such a way that within those lines there's a real sense of these lines, there's a real sense of surrealism that I find particularly enjoyable. Now, about that made-up word, did you know ahead of time that you were going to do a made-up word, like when you started the poem, or did you get to that point and go, I'm just going to make up a word, or how did that process work?
I did know I was going to make up a word because it was actually a requirement of the contest that I wrote it for.
Well, there you go. Okay. Well, that makes sense then. Very cool.
So it said I had to have at least one that wasn't a real word, so.
I had to look up frogging. But it is a word. Progger's a thing.
Yeah,
it fits so well.
Oh,
it fits so well in that sequence.
Frogging is a thing,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you even question yourself, right? After learning about Gigalog, you wonder about frogging, and it just works so well, and you think it's all just lyrical play, and it works. Great poem. Your next one is Up and Ready Whenever You Are, Babbler. Tell me you love her.
All right. This is Tell Me You Love Her. Tell me how many moles she has on her back, about the one hair that stops short of the hairline, or the guffawing laugh when she's tickled just so. Tell me about how she blows up the bathroom after a night of rowdy drinking, what she likes on her eggs after a rough night of work. Tell me she only reads shampoo bottles and smokes cigarettes when she thinks she's alone. Tell me all the things you know that the cat callers don't, that the magazines won't sell. Tell me what she looks like after 5 hours of bawling her eyes out, about the food she hates, if she chews her nails, that she doesn't believe in tipping. Tell me what makes her human, and I'll know that you love her. End poem.
Yeah, and I love the message in this, because to know nuance about someone means that you're paying attention, and then that means it's true love. I mean, I think to dig in and to accept someone and to appreciate all of those itty-bitty secrets that they all have about themselves is to be truly in love. And I love the message of that, but there are a couple little hints that had me going a different way. The magazines won't sell, or tell me what makes her human, made me think that this was someone that was even greater than, like it was someone that the narrative voice was idolizing, and it was saying, okay, well, I love Charlize Theron. And you go, well, wait a minute. Do you even know if she smokes cigarettes? Do you even know how many moles she has on her back? What do you mean you love her? So it's almost like a challenge saying you can't love someone unless you know this nuance. So it kind of played in my mind of, well, maybe you don't want to know your heroes, because once you do know them, then you find those ugly moles and those rowdy nights of drinking, and then all of a sudden they're not someone that you put up on that pedestal. So my mind went two different ways with this one, and I'm kind of curious about what your intent was, if I'm right on either front.
Oh, I think it's a pretty astute observation, because it actually was inspired by a conversation very similar to that. I'm a member of some different fan groups that have different idols, but sometimes you get the crazies in there that think that they're like actually in love with this person. And it's like, you don't actually know them. Like, you know, their public persona, and the fact that you can't or don't know how to draw the line between the person that is presented to you, person who they actually are, is like frightening. I think you have to know all of these dirty little things to really love somebody. You can care about them. You know, you can love who they are, but to actually be, like, in love with somebody, you have to know who they actually are. And who they actually are is who they are when the door is closed, celebrity or not. And to love all of those things. You sometimes not just in spite of, but because of these things, you know, because that's what makes someone actually a human being.
100%. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, no, you can almost fall in love. It's two different kinds of love. You can fall in love with a person because of all their warts and bumps, or you can also fall in love with the idea that you yourself have created of that person without even knowing all those pieces. Cool. Hey, cool. I like the poem. Pam, you're up. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I really like this one too. I liked your observations, Jeremy, and the conversation that came from it. And I think you make a really good point with this one, Babbler, in the idea that, you know, true love is getting to know a person and what they're like behind the doors, and, you know, the difference between admiration or a crush and actual true love. And I like how there is this kind of challenging tone to this, like, where you keep repetitively saying, tell me, and then I'll believe you. And now is the point in the show, which is my generic question, which is, what was it that got you into poetry?
Oh, you know, I have no idea. I don't know how old I was when I first started reading poems. You know, I grew up without power, as I've mentioned several times. So when people talk about, like, fireside poets and stuff like that, it actually brings me right back to my childhood, because my brother and I would read to each other all the time. And it's funny that T. Eastpoe earlier mentioned Edward Lear, because he was one of my favorites as a kid. My favorite were definitely Lear, Frost. I really loved Frost as a kid. And we would just read poetry back and forth to each other. I was really blessed with a older brother who really meshed well with me, despite the fact that I'm 4.5 years younger than him. You know, we bonded a lot over reading. We would switch books back and forth and run into each other's rooms to, like, exclaim over our favorite parts. We're like, wait till you get to page 97. Like, that was a thing. So I don't, and that just kind of naturally led into me writing. So I don't really remember when I started writing poems. Occasionally I go through some of my old diaries from my childhood and read some of my truly terrible poetry.
Oh, I think we all have that. It's so funny.
It's so bad, but it makes me laugh because you got to start somewhere, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
For me, cool. It was just really, yeah, self-expression. And I read so much that it just seemed like a natural fall into writing. So.
Tank, what do you have to say to us?
When I first started listening to this, I thought it was about a jilted girlfriend asking her ex-boyfriend or saying, do you really know what? So then it went somewhere else and I thought, she's talking about an idol, a model, a film star or something like that. But I definitely got like, do you really know what she's like? You know, so it was definitely came across that sort of smashing the delusional, questioning hero worship, that sort of thing. But I thought it was maybe personal.
No.
I like that.
As far as I know of, I've never been cheated on. If I have been cheated on, they were very sneaky.
Well, and I think it's true. I think you picked up on it, Tank. I mean, it does have that accusatory tone that we talked about. And so, yeah, it could be from also even someone that doesn't believe in the love, doesn't believe it's real. So if it's from a jilted lover, that accusatory tone could even have a little bit more of a point to it. I like that take. Now, Babbler, before we move on, I know that you host a couple late-night shows yourself. Would you like to give yourself a shameless plug?
I co-host Part Sinner, Part Saint with the lovely Ephesiana on Friday night, Saturday morning, depending on your time zone. This time on Fridays. Yeah, and that's good fun of the show. We kind of handle... I've taken a mostly like mental health or darker topics, things about that, about the complexities of the human spirit, essentially, to match like the theme of our show. But it's a good time. I invite anybody to come check us out. I think we have fun on that show.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
I can attest that Babbler and Aphasion are a great team, and they do put on a wonderful show. So check them out on late night Friday nights. They do a good job, and it's a very entertaining conversation. And then is there anywhere else where we can find your work, Babbler? Do you have anything published or any other ways that we can get a hold, or are you strictly on AP?
I'm pretty much just here. Yes, because the rest of the writing I do is, like, in my personal journals that are written in paper at my house. So, you know, unless you're extreme stalker level, AP is the place to find me.
That was not an invitation to all the listening audience to sneak up and stalk Babbler. Awesome, awesome. Well, whenever you're ready, your next poem is up on the board, Mass Consumption.
All right. Mass consumption. I'm not for mass consumption. You make presumption about the function of my compunctions. I don't need Jesus. I just don't believe in duality or fatality or even futility. You feeling me? I'm just not spiritual. But that doesn't mean I'm unethical. It's incredible, the spectacle of your biblical pedestal. I'm not anti-clerical. Let me borrow your soapbox. Give straight talk while you sleepwalk. Make it into an ad hoc paradox. Then maybe you'll get it. We need to stop the propaganda, make a memoranda to get a hand up and stop eulogizing and stand up. There, I said it. I believe that humanity can stop the vanity of the raging insanity with or without Christianity. That's the beauty of it. We don't need an old triptych written in cryptic carved glyphics to fix this before it gets apocalyptic. We can rise above it. We need to work in tandem and hand in hand, man, not at random, not within our own fandom. Do you understand that? It's not about whose God is superior, it's about the interior, because here we are acting like we're venereal, we're ravaging our own planet. Put down the Kool-Aid, see the air raids and the unfair trade, rebel religious wars made while you prayed. I'm talking about trying reason. Many are on their last hope, can't cope looping up that fat rope while you're reciting old tropes. Shouldn't matter what they believe in. Every person has a purpose, they're not worth this or worth this, but what's worse is they don't need Jesus. End poem.
Great read. Great read. Pam, you need to start us off, please.
Absolutely. I really love how Babbler, you tackle the subject of religion, of humanity, of how, you know, one size doesn't fit all. This has just spot on, hard-hitting rhyme and flow to the point where it could pretty much be a rap. Like this, you could put this to a backbeat, and it would be absolutely amazing. You know, I know there are certain subjects that we tend as poets a lot of times to avoid because we're afraid of stepping on people's toes. And one of those, of course, is religion. Then there's politics. Then there's, you know, whatever else, you know, that can possibly come out of our mouths to offend every little crybaby out there, you know. But what I like is that you acknowledge that this isn't what you need. This isn't your religion. This isn't your beliefs. But you don't put other people down for their spiritual beliefs. But what we do take a look at in these lines, let me borrow your soapbox, give straight talk, but allow you sleepwalk, is the idea that too many people out there are standing on a soapbox preaching to the audience when they ought to be preaching to ourselves or to themselves. I really liked this all the way through. I liked the message of it. I like how you always are, you do have this way of oftentimes tackling unexpected and bold topics. Do you ever find yourself when you write something like this getting nervous about what the response will be?
yeah. I mean, of course, my goal is never to, like, set out to offend anyone. However, my part of my goal is to be authentically myself, and I can be a bit rough around the edges, so it doesn't really shock me when people get offended, but I also don't want to write bullshit, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to stand myself down to be palatable for other people. But it's not my goal to offend people. And I knew when I wrote this piece that there were going to be people who only scratched the surface of what it was about. You know, they'll get to the end of that first stanza where I say that I don't need Jesus and get angry, you know, and then that's going to color the rest of their reading of this piece as being anti-religious, despite the fact that it says numerous times in the poem that I am not anti-religious.
Right. Exactly.
I'm anti-judgment. I don't need Jesus. Maybe you do, and that's fine. You know, but there's a lot of gods out there and a lot of religious things that people buy into, you know, and believe. You know, even not believing is believing and, you know, not that. Like, you know, it shouldn't be just about selling your religion. It should be about helping people as people, as a group, you know, and not fighting about whose God is better. You know, like, but I knew that when I wrote this, that there were people who were going to stop at I don't need Jesus and assume that this poem was going to be anti-religious. But it's not really meant that way. But at the same time, I didn't want to make my intro softer because I think almost in a way making the beginning a little bit inflammatory makes it a little more hard-hitting of a piece. You know, I can't write, like, I'm not interested in Jesus. Like, that's not my voice for the poem, you know?
So, yep.
Anyway, so yes.
Well, you certainly didn't put off your buddy Fazy because she's saying she loves this one so much. She's saying it needs to be studied in a book club. Tink, what are your thoughts about this poem?
Well, the first word that came into my head, of course, was rap. And that this is one kick-ass rap poem. I mean, you know, there you are in your combat boots and your camouflage, and you're not taking any shit from anybody. So I like that. And I don't like end rhyme, but this is brilliant. What it's about, it's that rappy thing, that repetitive beat that just barrels on down through here. It's just brilliantly achieved. And I really like that message that it's not compulsory to believe. It's not compulsory to believe in anything. And if you want to believe in something, you can believe in anything. That's very much my stance. And I think this is just a neat exposition of that. And it's a suitable package to put that message in because it's not preachy and it's punchy.
And great comment, Tink. And to expand upon that, I agree, and that's really what stood out to me as well. I mean, the fact that it is punchy and it's rhyming and it's so comfortably metered throughout the whole thing is an inclusive feel, right? It gets the reader in and they get comfortable with the cadence of the poem. And that's really the huge kind of juxtaposition of the whole thing, is because the message of the poem is, you know what, I don't want to be included. I don't want to be part of some kind of greater organization that has some kind of dogma to it, cadence to it, rules to it that I don't want to conform to. So there was kind of this subtext of duality in the poem that really kind of hit me hard, and I really like that choice. I don't know, I mean, you can expand upon it if you'd like that, but were you realizing that conscious choice to make it so melodic and rhyming with something that's so anti-establishment was kind of a duality to the poem?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, especially when you look at just even the title or the first line, you know, mass consumption, you know, there's even like a duality in the meaning of that, you know, and then even when you get to the part where, you know, I talked about borrowing the soapbox, you know, it's like we need to stop using trite tropes to convince people to do things. But paradoxically, I'm going to tell you that by giving you a bunch of tropes. I mean, yeah. It was very intentionally dual purpose. It's kind of like it reminds me a little bit of a comic that I read on Instagram, weirdly enough, that's called Yes But, that shows you one thing and then shows you like a larger context or circumstance that kind of throws that into like comedic relief. It was intentional.
I like that, and I'm really proud of myself that I was able to get through a poem that deals with religion without totally making an ass of myself, Pam. What do you think?
I have to say, bravo. You did awesome.
I tried not to be too awkward this time. All right. Valor, we got your next one up whenever you're ready. Beating around the bush.
Okay, so I'm going to give this just a little bit of pretext. This one is written in direct defiance of the rules of most of all poetry's contests, which say they don't want sexual language about putting tab A into slot B, which I think is directly from Pam.
Yeah, this is mocking me.
Grab this and just go way too far with it. So this is beating around the bush. I want to put my tab A into your slot B, if you know what I mean. Let's make Whoopi a two-backed beast. Dance the tango, the horizontal mambo, have a bit of crumpet, a bit of how's your father, the old in-out, your mama's squeeze box, you know what I'm saying? Talk about assault with a friendly weapon. Old Bam Bam in the ham, putting a little banana in the fruit salad. Wham Bam, thank you, ma'am. I mean banging, basket making, belly bumping, bending you over a barrel, bodging, boffing, boinking, bow chicka wow wow, you know, bumping uglies. Bringing al dente noodles to the spaghetti house, buttering the biscuit, cattle prodding you the oyster ditch with the laugh rocket, cocking the tub, cave diving, the old plunge, creaming the Twinkie. Saying we should get busy, dipping the wick, disappointing the wife, doing squat thrusts in the cucumber patch, you get me? You and me, doing the dirty, doing the do, doing the horizontal greased weasel tango, the nasty, the wild thing, it. Entangling the lower beard, forking, hosting meetings for the funny business, holding joint sessions of Congress, getting to know each other, biblically. We should be getting busy, getting down, getting it on, getting laid, getting some. Let me hit that home run, go all the way, score. Caught up in some gland-to-gland combat, hanging at the Y, some hanky-panky. Hide that bishop, smash that upvote button, get ready for a hot beef injection intromission. Let's get to jamming the clam, jumping your bones, jumping the turnstile, knobbing and knocking boots. How about we talk about launching this meat missile, laying that pipe, making some bacon, mashing the fat, making some monkey business if you're into that. Tell me what you think about nailing, opening the gates of Mordor, oscillating the unmentionable. Get yourself ready for the dance-off, pants-off, shagging. We can play pelvic pinochle or hide the cannoli, pogo in the shrubs, poke the squid, polish the porpoise, ponder the unicorn, good old porkin'. I gotta see a man about a dog, shaking the sheets, baby, shucking the oyster, slamming the clam, putting the wand in the chamber of secrets. How you feel about death by snoo-snoo or snuffing the muffin, taking old one eye to the optometrist. I'm down for two-person push-ups, trying the true lover's knot and violating the prime directive. Let's get freaky. What do you mean, no?
Oh my gosh, I was laughing. Oh, I love it. What a great read. Tink, you're up first.
Oh, you would do that. Okay. Well, of course, this poem's a complete failure without the last line. it's like the list poem to end all list poems. I really don't know. I mean, there's not a lot one can say apart from a big giggle. I don't know which book you looked at or which website. I'm sure you don't have all of these up your sleeve to use on a Saturday night, because quite frankly, they're pretty off the wall, but I'm going to borrow some of them, that's for sure. Yeah, just hilarious.
And then there's so many that are familiar. I mean, gosh, just being a goofy guy. Yeah, there's so many that are funny. The one I love the best is from Futurama, Death by Snoo Snoo. I caught that reference. It was hilarious. But it reminds me of a class in school, Dirty 230, where at the beginning it's sex ed class back in college. And what they did in the first 10 minutes is they let everyone just yell out all the different slang terms they had for male and female genitalia. And it's a funny reference how everyone just says a lot of these things, and the spirit that you have with this babbler. I mean, really, if you look at the deeper message of it, is the awkwardness and how odd it is, the whole courtship process, and how obnoxious it can be. And to just put it all out there in the front and the forefront and say, you know what, this is Quagmire coming up to you at the bar and just kind of laying it all out there. And you just giggle. I mean, it's funny. It's funny all of the references you have here. And even the way you organized it made it all that much more poetic, because I think just to make it a flat-out list of things wouldn't have worked as well as how you paid attention to the interlinkings of all of this. And it was a wonderful performance. I giggled all the way through. Great poem.
Yeah.
Pam, your comments.
Yeah, this definitely wonderful sense of humor. I have to agree, it is a great performance piece. I love how you came up with all these different phrases. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you put them together. And there's some here that I've never heard, and obviously some very familiar ones. A two-backed beast, dance the tango, the horizontal mamba. Mambo, have a crumpet, a bit of how's your father, the old in and out, in, out. You know, just wonderful lines all the way through. I really enjoyed your sense of humor, and I really enjoyed how you could hear the enthusiasm and the laughter in your voice as you were reading. So very well done.
Thanks. Yeah, this was just fun to write. Yeah, thinking of, like, every possible euphemism I could possibly come up with, and how to make them sound good together. Anyway, it was fun to write. I just felt like breaking the rules that day. That's honestly all it was.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes, though, you got to have fun and break the rules. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You have to smash religion and you smash sex.
The next one is on the board. Let's find out. Whenever you're ready, Babbler. Dog piss.
Talk about a change in tone. Okay, this is dog piss. The semicircle off my back stoop is naked brown. The grass shied away from the lifted legs of dogs, too tired or cold or lazy to take more than three steps into the morning, and I not caring enough to chase them out any further. A lazy half-ring of dog and man's distaste for effort when just enough will do. End poem.
This reminds me of one of my old English teachers way back in the day. Quick nod to you, Tom Wiley, because good enough seldom is. And I like that message of this one. There's a laziness. There's the sloth that's identified. But it's not – it's self-deprecating. You're realizing that the problem of all of this isn't just because the dog is going up the same spot and peeing. It's because the narrative voice isn't taking the effort to give the dog the greater option to go out and do something – to go out and see the world, take them for a real walk, go out and exercise. So I like the fact that, I mean, even though the title is dog piss, but really the accusatory finger is pointing at oneself is what I got out of it. And I like the fact that the problem or the ugliness, the dead ring of grass is self-inflicted as opposed to really blaming the dog itself. So do you have a backstory or something else you want to talk to about this one or where this one came from?
This was literally me drinking my morning coffee, looking at my backyard and going, why is the grass dead, like 6 feet around my back stoop? And I realized, oh, it's just because the dogs pee there, like, every day. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do something about it. And then I'm like, no, I'm just as lazy as the dog. So, like, it's not
there
in the house. Good enough.
There it is. There it is.
It was just an acknowledgement of me going, oh, good enough, I guess. I'm not doing anything more about it. They're certainly not going to change their habits. So I guess I'll have a 6-foot ring of dead grass around my back porch all winter.
There it is. Pam, what are your thoughts?
I really appreciate and enjoy this one. I like that you brought a brevity to the table because I noticed that you, in general, tend not to write brevity. So, you know, very cool there. I love the Bukowski kind of feel to it, how it's that everyday imagery that, you know, that look at the piss stains of life and, you know, the self-observation of our own downfalls. So really just an amazing write and very well done.
Great comment. Great compliment. Tink, you're up. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not a dog keeper, so I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. It's a wry look at a particular part of life. It's delightful in a sort of buck way.
Absolutely. Well, Babbler, I think we'll have time for at least one more. I can keep going down your list. Your next one is Rat City, or would you like to pick anything further down your list, or are you comfortable with Rat City?
Let me see what all is on there real quick. Try to get to the list. Rat City should be fine, but let me... I think that's fine. Rat City's fine. I tried to pick a diverse, lots of different kinds of what I write. So Rat City's fine.
I think you were very successful. Give us a very diverse list. Now, this is a great swath across your body of work.
Mm-hmm.
So Rat City is in the queue now, whenever you're ready.
This is Rat City. The Rat City homeless, with pockets full of lint, knows what it is to be Rat City rich. Hit the pavement with flopping soles, slapping out the rhythm, broken asphalt crumbling underfoot, dancing to the music in the mind. This is Rat City, people living under bridges, tent towns on sidewalks, bodies rolling in the ditch. But this man, with his pockets full of lint, dancing in the ghetto, is Rat City rich. Shopping carts of treasures, worth not a penny, wrapped in plastic, smelling like shit. Ain't got no job to lose his mind to, no sense to rub, no sales to pitch, because this man, he's Rat City rich. Huddled in a doorway as the sun goes down, humming the bass line of that internal song, dum-ba-dum-doo-wah. He doesn't want your help. It's where he wants to be, sitting in this alcove wrapped in papers. He's Rat City rich. Loving what he's got, slamming on that whammy bar with a rosy disposition. There's no explanation for his smile, blooming in a sidewalk crack of missing teeth, garden, watered with piss, humming and strumming on an air guitar, peeking into heaven, because he's Rat City rich. End poem.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful read. You get to start us off, Pam.
All right. Well, first of all, I really love the whole jazzy type feel to this, the beat poet feel, the repetitiveness of the lines, he's Rat City rich. I like the deep message of this, the whole idea of how rich is different for different people and in different areas. And oftentimes, you know, what one person considers poor, another doesn't, especially depending on, you know, what all they have or have had throughout their life. I really like shopping cart of treasures worth not a penny, wrapped in plastic, smelling like shit, ain't got no job to lose his mind to, no sense to rub, no sales to pitch. I really like where you say, ain't got no job to lose his mind to, because it's almost, you know, it's both a positive and a negative at the same time, an observation of how, you know, tragic this guy's life is, and yet how much freedom he has in his ability not to be anchored down by a job. You know, just really amazing lines throughout. And damn it, I did have a question, but it has completely slipped my mind, so I will probably at some point, if I actually ever remember it, just have to private message it to you. But, yeah, this is an amazing write and very well done.
Wonderful compliment. Your thoughts, Tink?
Sorry, I'm just chewing on a Danish here. I like this a lot because it's about somebody who's got their priorities and they're living by their priorities and they don't give a shit for anything else and they found they're happy and they're being there. And I quite like that very much. I like the rappiness of this again. It really suits your brain, I think, to go fast down with a whole set of ideas. And they're also sort of society smashing ideas, which is nice. You know, I like that about your poetry. I like the element of musicality that you add in, and even with that lovely internal song, dum ba dum da do ah, lovely. It reminds me of this character. There was a guy who lived on the streets in New York called Moondog, and I have one of his pieces on my page. And he wanted to live on the streets. He wanted to make music about the sounds around him on the streets of New York. Do listen to that piece. It's unusual if you haven't heard of Moondog. Anyway, I thought this worked really, really well.
Thank you. I'll check it out, Moondog. Haven't heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pam, that's not a license for you to start calling me Moondog, by the way. Don't write that down.
Oh, come on, Moondog. No, I'm going to stick to calling you Pepcat.
That works. No, I mean, I think this is another one, Babbler. This is another one where you took your ability to really, again, I want to emphasize what Tink just said. You took the ability to put your rhythm and your beat and your cadence to your poetry, and it has an underlying feeling or an underlying message to the fact that you use that device and you use your talent to come through and how it emphasizes your message in this particular instance. Because what I took away from this is I remember listening to – oh, what's the name of it? I just had it. Radio Lab show or This American Life, one of those two NPR shows where they were talking about how money is fiction. And it kind of blew my mind at first with the concept of it, that wealth isn't really reality. It's a social contract with everyone else to have an agreement on what value really is. And in this poem, it's saying, you know what, my value, what I consider wealth, what I consider comfort in life is what I have right here. I'm Rat City rich. I am rich because I have everything I want living on the streets, listening to the sounds of New York, again, like what Tink said, of living in the moment and being where I am and embracing it. And that's just as much wealth as the house on the hill, in my opinion. I mean, it's really a state of mind, a state of acceptance, and a state of how you want to live your life. So I think if you let go a lot of society structure and society's norms and kind of let people be happy and be free with what they're comfortable with, then as long as they're not hurting anyone and they're happy, who's to judge? And I know, Babbler, that you're in the Pacific Northwest, and I know that we're seeing, because I am too, and I know that we're seeing in the bigger cities a lot more of the homeless situation grow. I mean, it's becoming a real big problem down where I am, and a challenge, let's put it that way. Does this poem come from your experience or your view or your – I mean, it was a year ago, so I don't think it had come to the point that it is now in terms of the homeless situation. But what is the underlying vein, I guess, that you want to get across, or what was your feelings or your experiences that motivated this poem?
Well, I mean, a few different places. I mean, one, I grew up really poor. You know, I grew up in an old city trailer park. But on top of that, my brother lived in Seattle and in an area where there's a lot of homeless population, White Center, which is a suburb of Seattle, and it's called Rat City because of the homeless population there. You know, but people make a lot of assumptions that homeless people don't want to be homeless. But I have personally known several people who have directly chosen to be homeless. Didn't have to be homeless. Like, there's no reason that they need to be homeless. But they're sick of society's standards and, like, what they feel like they're forced to do. And while that's not my own personal worldview, I can certainly respect it, you know. And I think there's a lot of judgment that goes into to looking at homeless people. And not a lot of understanding of maybe where they're coming from, like the fact that some of them just don't have the same values as you do. Yeah, there's substance abuse, there's mental health issues, there's a lot of reasons that people are homeless, but some of those reasons are because they want to be. A lot of attention for that, even though I've encountered it myself. So that's kind of what I was thinking when I wrote this.
Well, it's a great poem, and it was a great body of work. I'm sorry we didn't get further through it. It seems like an hour is never quite enough. So if you want to see Babbler's full selection of what she had prepared tonight, please click on the link for the show. I always forget to mention that our headliners do spend a lot of time coming up with a preferred set of poems that they want to share with everyone, and unfortunately we don't get to make it through most of them or all of them. So please check out more of her work on that, or just type her up on AP and see her full body. Babbler, you are an excellent headliner tonight. Thank you for all your honesty and sharing your work. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
And next, from across the pond, second headliner tonight, Bright and Early. And I posted the wrong poem. I'm sorry. Bright and Early on her time is Tink. Tink, are you ready to do this?
No, I'm asleep now.
Well, whenever you're ready. I know that you had mentioned that you might want to jump around, so please just give me a nudge if you don't want to read the next one on your list. I posted the first one, A Taxonomy of Existence, so let's start there. But after that, if you want to jump around, it's your hour, so go at it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Jeremy. This is a really nice thing to do. I was going to say my first one because it knits into Babbler's poem there, but let's go with the first one and we can have the Arizona one second. So, okay, A Taxonomy of Existence. I've put this up first because it's the last poem that I posted, and I found it very difficult to order my work or actually come up with a suitable knit of things, so a bit of a splattergun approach, but here we go. Taxonomy of existence. I imagine that plants know nothing of their names, a taxonomy to frame their existence. The word was made flesh, and so it became, petaled and leaved and rooted, decayed and soiled and broken. And the word became language, became religion, made war and poor and division. And I swear I've forgotten the word for poetry.
I love this one. I love this one. I remember the first time when you posted it a little while ago, and I loved it. One of my obsessions, one of my unhealthy obsessions, is the John Krakauer book, and then made into the movie Into the Wild. And there's a point in there where the lead character has to name every plant, and he's obsessed with knowing everything by its biological name. And it's ironic because he dies because he says he eats the wrong thing, but calling everything its specific name, and that's what it reminded me of. And that's what I took of this, is knowing things for what their titles are and what their essences are, and appreciating that. And then the fact that at the end of this, because it's a poem, you get so focused on the fact that I want to know essence, and you go, oh, wait a minute. Maybe by me talking about essence, I've forgotten what this is all about. I've forgotten about poetry. So it's kind of like this, oh, my gosh, aha, what have I lost moment that is really subtle in its message. And I really found it beautiful, though. I found it beautiful that you can – that the message being that you become so hyper-focused, you can't see the forest for the trees because you're so hyper-focused on what you want things to be in order and essence in exactness, that you forget which way the yellow brick road leads, I guess. I don't know. Is there something else that you want to, some other insight that you can give me on this, puppy?
Sorry, is puppy?
Puppy on this pup, on this poem. I'm sorry. Is there, I apologize. Is there some other insight you can give me on this poem? on this puppy, on this bad dog, on this hunk of burning love.
Okay. Remember, I'm English. I don't really understand everything you're saying.
I know. I picked up. I'll tame my slang down. Sorry about that.
Do you know, I was thinking about this. I don't often write things that are as short as this. It's kind of brevity. But I think it's got in it more than a lot of longer poems that I've written. And I would say that this probably has taken about 30 years or more since I was a student to distill, really. And the quote that I was an art student. I did fine art. And there's one thing that's rattled around my brain. And I sort of, you know, you have those things that are important to you. And this came out of that. It's a quote from Barnett Newman. Barnett Newman was an American abstract expressionist. And he said, aesthetics is to artists as ornithology is to the birds. And I think that this is my response to that, the way that I've thought about the taxonomy of things and how unimportant names are, the labels that we give things. And sometimes it's useful to strip away the labels and see things without preconception. So I think that's partly where I was coming from with this.
I like that insight. I like that a lot. Babbler, are you still with us? Do you have some comments?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good.
I really like this piece. I wrote a comment on it, but my first thought is like, well, yeah, well, what the hell would a daisy give two shits about Linnaeus? Like, there? You know, and that's just, I like this, and I think it's good that it's a brevity because it's about the limitation of words. And they're useful until they're not. They're useful until they become limiting. Because sometimes a word fits something so perfectly, you know, by the definition and the context around it and the social understanding of what it means, that it's like, yes, that's the perfect word for what I'm looking for. But sometimes no perfect word exists. And in those instances, language becomes a limitation. And for me, I feel like that's kind of what this is about, is when you start defining things and trying to find ways to wedge them into a language, you chop off some of the bits that can be defining about what it is. So I really liked this piece. I thought it was beautifully simple and yet layered and philosophical. So I really enjoyed the write.
Great comment, Babbler. And Pam, what would you like to contribute?
Well, I think it's beautifully written. I really like, Tink, the extra insight that you gave into this. And I like how you brought in the idea of how being obsessed with language almost becomes like a religion, as you say, and the word became language, became religion, made war and poor and division. Like, if we didn't have those kind of labels, would we have nearly as much division as we have in society? I think this is beautifully written and really poignant. So very well done.
That is a biblical reference as well.
Oh, yes. I know.
Yeah.
But thank
you. Wonderful, right? Wonderful comments. Tank, your next poem, Gnat's Piss to a Flea of Time, is up whenever you're ready.
Okay. Gnat's Piss to a Flea of Time. Conscious gnat. Go on, jump if you can. Orders of magnitude beyond cognition. Ice caps melt in their own sweet time. As if we can even conceive of that without 80 years plus 10 bouncing from its tail like an important equation. Aeons and aeons of creaking seconds. And the viscosity of rocks as they rip through the universe, spinning helical through cold dark matter as a fact without its own feet. Imagined as all of time is immaterial, melt ice, boil rock, or so I jog round the streets on repeat like a hamster preening until the next meal. Meals wheel round the supper supermarket, tasty this, drunk that. From my area of privilege, my ledge above the trees, I camera, I pot, write, and weed, and bite on truth if it isn't drunk under the table. I fire earth cloaked in mineral melt. Silica wonder why I can't erase the past of the making of my clay. End poem.
That is such an awesome ending. What a great write. Your first babbler, what are your thoughts?
Well, I really love the geology that's kind of wound into this piece and yet tied to the gnat's piss. To a flea of time, like such a minute thing, such a tiny thing, like who thinks about tiny flies peeing? I mean, you obviously, and us, thanks to you, but you know, just the scale of things, the vast difference in, and it made me kind of think about, you know, I lived in a house that was about 100 years old, and it had all the original windows, and they had warped. And I had to remind myself, like, glass is a liquid. It seems like a solid because it's time is different for myself and the glass. Like, we are operating on vastly different scales. And so I loved the idea of thinking about geology and humanity in the same time frame, and what relativity would look like that from a glacial perspective, you know, probably shorter than the life of even the gnat appears to us, you know, harried and short. but I liked it. I think it put things into an interesting perspective. So I enjoyed it very much.
Great comment. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I really like the play on words with the spelling of flea in the title. I like the spacing of how you chose to use spacing to with your poem with ice caps melt in their own sweet time, so that each word is separate. So you're meant, the reader is meant to take those lines slowly as if they are reading the ice cap melting in its own time. You know, this is, as I said, beautiful use of spacing and powerful imagery. I really like how this, you know, to me really just kind of speaks on the whole idea of observing daily life and wondering where it's going to, and wondering, you know, where we kind of stand in it. It's all, it kind of feels very philosophical. You know, Can I ask, because I see this isn't in a contest, what was it that inspired this poem?
I think it's just one of my preoccupations, that the, you know, the daily, the quotidian thing every day, you do the same thing, and the earth is doing the same thing every day, and the sun comes around every day, and we have so many preoccupations. And it's all going to happen anyway. Yeah.
Very cool. I like that.
And I want to tag on to that because I'm like Pam. I'm really big on formatting of poems. And I like what she pointed out in individual lines and how that makes it stand out. But I also liked, especially when you're performing it, and I don't know if it comes up in another later poem, but I really am taken – I really take a lot of interest in what the body and the end of this poem and how conversational it feels, how autobiographical it feels, how it feels like you're journaling. And when you just gave that explanation, Tink, I mean, really, that is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's you going through the monotony, the repetition of day to day. And especially, I mean, what stood out is at the very end is my ledge above the trees. I love I camera, I pot, and write, and weed, and bite. I love that because, yeah, it is the eaches of every day and what you're going through the motions almost. You're doing it and you're identifying it, and because there's no capitalization and the way that you spaced it just feels like that drudgery almost, if that's even the right word. So I think it came through really well. I liked your explanation you just gave, Pam. The other part that I found on this was the scale of all of it. It's you go in, like what Babla was saying from the very beginning with the microscope, and you're looking at the gnat's pee or whatever, and then you're zooming way out into the universe, and you're tying it all together with your day-to-day, and it's kind of it's a lens looking in and out and kind of trying to make sense of where oneself fits in the greater scheme of everything. And I was wondering, when I was taking it from that aspect, I was wondering if there was any kind of deeper question of creativism, or if there's any kind of deeper philosophical thing that you had in this. Creationism is the word I'm looking for, actually. Was any of that coming into play with all of this?
I think it's pretentious if I kind of expand this into a kind of general philosophy. So I think I'd rather just leave. It's not that I don't. Yes and no.
It's your hour, Tink. You can be as pretentious or not as you want. Whatever you want to say. It's all about you.
One thing I'd like to say about Babel, I think that thing about the glass is really brilliant, because the in the old houses in England, the old glass is thicker at the bottom than the top, because it flows down with gravity. And really, you know, glass from the 16th and 17th century, in particular, you know, it's thicker at the bottom than the top considerably. Yeah. Right. That's it.
Very slow liquid.
That's right. Well, wonderful poem. And I have your next one up. And again, if you want to change the conversation and the narrative, please just let me know.
Yeah, I've got one I was going to put up as my second one. It's not actually on the list, but I would like to read it as talking about formatting. So is it possible to bring one up that's not on my list?
Well, yeah, it's going to take me a second. So if you can hum us a tune or something and give me the title of it, yeah, I think I can find it. What's the name of it?
It's called Distillery.
Tank Distillery. You know what's really good? You know what's really good about in audio shows is dead silence. That usually gets people calling back in drones.
It's very interesting for me because Poem Distillery is written as it's about a state of mind, and I wanted to put this in because it's not about depression. It's about that kind of shutdown moment. And you were talking about the formatting in Macpis, and this one is extreme formatting, but I see it as a way of using language and formatting and well, they look like made-up words, but making it difficult to read the poem because at that moment in time, it's difficult for the person, or at some moments it's difficult to speak or talk or do anything. And I wondered how I could do that in a poem without being articulate. So have you got it on the screen?
I do. We have it up. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. The cuminous. Absorbs all and yet empty, air-filled, inert, turbulent-less, not even swirls of dust. Thoughts collide and disappear, a cave boreal and dark, tiger terrain of frost, hibernate, a theatre of knots, caught in tangled dreammares, dazed, slipshod into darkness, a species of stillroom, distillery of trust. End poem.
Wow, very cool, very cool. Pam, you get to go first.
All right, so first question, were you drunk when you wrote this?
No, it's a very serious poem. And no, it's okay. And I wanted to, it's like I said, it's about presenting a poem in a way that is inaccessible, because sometimes, maybe in a state of depression or shutdown, I wanted to express inaccessibility. You know, sometimes you can't say anything and nothing comes out. Nothing comes in really, but you know, you're in a state of suspension, and I wanted to express that in a poem. And this
Yeah, I like the idea of being able to express the inexpressible. I do like how you cram words together that, you know, the pressing together. It's like, to me, when something's pressed together like that, there's such a sense of carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. I really particularly like not even swirls of dust, thoughts collide and disappear. It makes me think of the whole idea of just being overwhelmed by what's going on inside of you. It definitely is, you know, especially to me and the way my mind works. It's very difficult for me to read words and phrases that are pushed together. And I find all the time when people use format, they tend to use spacing or the falling down of letters more in format rather than looking at pushing together of words. And so that you did that really shows a unique way of thinking. I would like to ask you also, so what was it that got you into writing poetry?
Well, like I said, I was an art student, and the notebook is a constant companion for everything. You write, well, I did write everything down, and I suppose I wasn't writing poetry, but I was making not prose. I would write things down in lists and short sentences, and I suppose I kind of thought of those as entities, really.
not as poems, but I would definitely be interested in the words. I didn't call them poems. I used to have a house in Scotland, and it's a very poetic place, Scotland. So I started writing poetry there, but I was writing what I thought was poetry. I think that's where everybody starts. And you know, it. And then, you know, there's a big pressure on what poetry should be. And then I realized I can actually write whatever I like. It always felt like I was wearing somebody else's clothes. And the stuff that I'm writing now feels like my clothes. And I guess that's why it's the shape it is. And this piece, which is airless, which is why the words are pushed together for those airless times when your life feels compressed. So I started writing poetry seriously, I suppose, about 10 years ago. And it was a slow process. And I didn't really know I was doing it, which was very strange. And then it's just gathered momentum now. And it's an important part of the work that I do.
Wonderful.
Great answer, Tank. And I love that you finally said that you feel like you're finally wearing your clothes. That was a very beautiful way to describe it. In this poem, I've never seen anything like this, Tank, and I love it. I love the airlessness that you just described when you're doing it, because you do feel that constrictive feeling to it. And it's funny that you read it, because as someone that, I mean, this is the first time I've seen it, and you read it flawlessly because it's your poem and you know the feeling, you know how to unravel the little puzzle that is these compressed words. And I look to the third line especially because I keep wanting to say Andy instead of and yet empty. And so it's funny how the eye plays tricks on me when I'm trying to understand and I'm trying to get rid of that suffocation of this. And I don't know. I really think it's a very clever way to convey that point. The other one that I just fell in love with was Cotton Tangled Dreammares. I think that was really cool. And I've seen it and I've done it to hurry along a line just by taking one or two words and pushing them together to make to add some kind of speed to the poem or to the line. But as an overall message in this, yeah, I think it is a very, it comes across like Pam's initial comment, it comes across as something that's comical and funny just because it's so entangled. But yeah, when you get the feel of exactly what you're saying, it's something very different and a very cool poetic device. Again, something that I've never seen before. And again, I just want to say kudos for doing something so out of the box, because I think it's a very successful device. So yeah, very cool. Babbler, your thoughts?
I really loved this piece. I'm someone who has occasional bouts of dissociative depression, which can be a hard thing to explain to someone who doesn't experience it. But I think this captures an aspect of it, at least from my perspective, that I relate to, where I'm having thoughts really fast, and they're so fast that they almost don't materialize. And so I don't express them because they're here and gone so quickly, it's almost like they weren't there at all. You know, so then people are like, what are you thinking about? And it's like, nothing, which isn't even inaccurate because I barely remember the thought that I had. And it all seems so ethereal and impossible to grab. So I really, it kind of brought me to that kind of headspace that I've experienced. And you can't really explain it very well to someone else if they haven't been there, because it's hard enough to even explain it. I really loved this use of spacing to kind of get at that. At least that's what it got at it for me, is that there's this flash in the pan, so fast and complex thoughts, but they're not expressible because they were not fully fleshed. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. It's like everything and nothing at once. Excellent, right?
Wonderful comment, Babbler. And Tink, can you tell us, before we go into the next one, can you tell us a little bit more about your work and where we can find you? Obviously, you're here on AP, and you had mentioned that you're also part of another, I think it was a Skype group where you can converse with poets, other poets. Is there anywhere else we can find your poetry?
No. There will be. But I'm working on a book of my photography, and I think I'm going to put poetry in there too. But it's a big internal conversation that I'm having at the moment, because I'm not sure that poetry needs illustration. And if I put my photograph with the poetry, it'll look like illustration. So I'm thinking on how I can do that. It may be two books. It may be one. Who knows?
Wow. Interesting thought. Yeah, because I've always wondered how to make my poems more visually sexy. And I wondered about that. I wonder if pairing them with photographs or with illustrations, because many poets do it, to make it more appealing to the masses. But I mm-hmm. like that you're taking a deeper pause with that thought. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. if you're a talented photographer and you're into poetry, it would be natural to put them together. But if you don't want to compromise one art form for the other, I really like that. I cheers to you for thinking so much about it and being so respectful of your own talents. And mm-hmm. so when you do publish it, please let us know or give us a way to get a hold of your books, because we'd love to celebrate them. Check them out.
Yep, we'll do. And also my website, I took that down because it became very out of date, and I got sidetracked with life. So I'll let you know that when that's fully up and flying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Does your website celebrate both your poetry and your photography?
My art, yes.
All of your art. Oh, cool. Cool, cool. Yeah, definitely let us know. We'd be interested in checking it out. And I have another poem up. It's the next one on the list, because I failed so badly at pulling your last one up quickly. I have one ready in the wings whenever you're ready. Air to fluid to air.
All right. This is another experimental one, if you like. Air to fluid to air. Trade one background for another. One shattered crush, bright of city night, for a black island, a dream of silence. City whoosh. Traffic hummering, an air to fluid in the back city ground, identical oral mind in the dark black night of Atlantic North Sea thrummering, over the drum hum sea tidal crushing echoes, tympanic translation from fluid to air to fluid, white noise, unsleeping the city exchanged for the water white noise of the ocean's lunar bidding. And then, Orkney floats under sky-hung aura borealis, green misted curtain caught by a curvature of reflective light, an undulating wrap of space-time, the city's neon greens unsleeping time-space. There, I hear my sea tidal, white zhoom, zhoom, lulls the city air. End poem.
Wonderful read. That was excellent. Magical. What came to mind on this one, when I slow down, when I can't find my muse, when I can't write, I find that I'm most inspired by changing my surroundings, going to somewhere new and just a new city, a new place, a new spot, and that inspires me to write. So what took me back on this one was how much surroundings were explored. And I'm wondering if that's an influence in your right, an inspiration in your right, if the settings of where you are help you in your ability to be creative.
Well, I started writing poetry, what I thought was poetry, in Orkney when I had a house. It's an island that's north of Scotland, right off the top of John O'Groats. And it is just one of those places. It's an extraordinary island. And that's where I started writing poetry, or at least thinking that putting words in a poetic form was something that I wanted to do, definitely. And I was living in London as well at the time and traveling up and between the two places. And really why I needed to go to the island was because I found living in the center of London quite difficult because of the mass of people and the noise, the constant noise. And I thought when I went up to Orkney that it would be silent, but it's not. It's exactly the same noise. You get the Atlantic and the North Sea, because the island's very narrow. And I could see the sea north from the south, the east, and the west. and I could hear it as well. It's just where the North Sea and the Atlantic meet in a 6-mile stretch called the Pentland Firth. And it's extremely noisy, particularly at night. And that's when that you notice a white noise in the city is at night. And so when I got back to, when I used to go back to London, instead of being disturbed by the sound of the city, I'd say to myself, this is the sound of the sea. And London no longer was such a difficult experience for me. But it is white noise, and it is very similar, apart from the sirens. But that was why.
I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in, or I didn't grow up. I spent a lot of time in a third world country where there was a lot of street noise all of the time. And so, yeah, you have to make up excuses or a reason why it's not going to drive you crazy. So I like that. I like that mental exercise. Babbler, your thoughts.
Well, I love this piece and its focus on sound and that how that can really teleport you or set a scene or kind of take you to a place. It reminded me of my older sister's apartment that she had. I grew up out in the woods with no power, so I'm very used to, like, nature noises and not a lot of city noises. But she had an apartment in town, and she would watch me when I was little, and I would sit in her room and sleep. And she lived right next to the freeway. And so I would constantly hear cars drive by, and it'd be like whoosh, 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 whoosh. And it became like a really comforting sound to me. And I would almost pretend that it was the ocean. And it's just kind of stuck with me, this traffic noise. So reading this, it brought me right back to my sister's apartment when I was like maybe 7 or 8 years old. I know that noise very well. So for me, this was very comforting and extremely relatable because it reminded me, right, of being taken out of the woods and placed into my sister's apartment and imagining the ocean and knowing that it's just cars. The ocean mm-hmm. of traffic is kind of used to how I used to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, nostalgic for me. And I enjoyed it very much.
Great comments, Babbler. And your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, I really enjoy and appreciate this one. I really have liked getting to know you and your poetry, Tink, and your experimental style. I think it's really important for people to not, as I always say, get trapped in boxes, but rather to learn to experiment. You know, what I like here is that you not only experiment with the phrasing and the spacing, but, you know, also with punctuation, like where you have fluid period to air period to fluid period. So it allows the reader to, it feels very like fast paced that you, or not, you know, like that pause that comes with after each period is meant to transfer the way, how quickly, give the idea of how quickly, you know, the sound travels. You know, that's the idea I get. I also like how this speaks to me on the idea of how we so easily adjust, as you were talking about, how you had to, like, you know, look at, you know, tell yourself that the noise of traffic was like the noise of the ocean. And so a lot of what we hear is almost psychological in how we adjust to it. I brought up the use of the periods in this, but I'm wondering, when it comes to punctuation, do you adjust from poem to poem, or do you have a general idea of how often you like to use punctuation such as periods and commas?
I generally don't like to use punctuation, but capitalization. I do like periods. I occasionally use a comma. I like ellipsis a lot and dashes. but visually I prefer not to use punctuation. And also I like the end line breaks and spacing between words to be part of the way the poem's read. It's about being on the page. It's very difficult in AP because things are on the screen and some people are reading it on their phones, which just mashes everything up completely. So I think I'm a very paper visual person, coming from an art background as well. So how a poem looks, the shape of it, the spacing is all important. And if I use standard prose punctuation, I can't change it around so much. So just using period, comma, and ellipsis gives me a lot more freedom with formatting. And I can exactly where I want it on the page.
Very cool.
I love that. I love that you have that freedom to make it be exactly what you want it to be without following any kind of convention. I totally agree with the art form that way. Cool philosophy. I like that, Tank. Your next poem is on the board whenever you're ready. I never live in Arizona.
Okay. Now, this is the one that I think kind of meshes with Babblers, the Rat City one. The man here is doing the Rat City. But this is, I was in Arizona. I've only spent a very short time in Arizona. But I remember this like it was yesterday. So I will never live in Arizona. Slipped by in the sand time, funneled squeeze point of my days, the possible of all possibilities, imagined like the not available forever knots of chance, struck with the memory of the happily mystical-eyed man living at the crossroads near a truck stop where the air was fast and thin, the light as if off the sea. This is the best place in the world to be. I live here because there is nowhere else, he said to me, and it was, I could feel it, see it in the dust and the sand and the harsh, soft, reflected light of this mundane, ethereal, tarmacked cross in the desert, a high, flat, knowing place. Did he shape his life any more than me? Was he able to choose? Was his freedom to cut out the possible of all possibilities?
Gosh, I love the way you end poetry. Your ending lines are just magical. Babbler, your comments first, please.
I like this. I like this because it starts with, I will never live in Arizona. You know, and at first, that makes me think, oh, is this poem going to be about how much you dislike Arizona? Like, I went there and it was just a complete shithole. But it's not what it's really about. You know, it's about going there and finding someone who sees the world so vastly differently, mm-hmm. and that they live here, live as in, like, the embodiment of their life, like their essence, their being, exists in this particular time and place, and it's kind of set aside for them and not you, and you will never live in their Arizona, you know, and I like the empathy of the piece. You know, I could feel it, see it in the dust and the sand, the harsh, soft, reflected light of this mundane, ethereal, tarmacked cross in the desert, to see it anew, to see it through how you think that maybe he saw it, you know, to share the vision for a moment, almost like a mirage, and to know that it's not yours. It is, and it's whole, but it's not of you. And so I really liked that, the empathy of the piece, you know, to be in a time and a place and experience something secondhand for a second. I really liked it. You know, it's to me, it's a piece about empathy and understanding. Seeing things differently, you know, and seeing maybe what another person sees. So I thought it was a wonderful write. I thought it was very emotionally effective.
Thank you.
Great comments, Babbler. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a beautiful write. It has wonderful imagery. I like that. Is this a true story?
Yes, it is. And the guy was, all there is in this crossroads is a gas station and the, somewhere to eat. And this shack, this guy was living in a shack. And he was just, it felt to me the most extraordinary place I've ever been. I couldn't put my finger on it. And I went over and talked to this guy. And he actually lived in the shack on this crossroads. And I said, what is it about this place? It's almost like a spaceship landing site. I mean, you can imagine, you could imagine waiting there to be taken away to somewhere else. And he lived there. He said, and he did say that to me, there is nowhere else to live. So it's a true story, totally.
Oh, wow. Very cool. I like that. I like that you shared this with us. And this is one of those experiences that seems so beautiful and raw and surreal. And the idea that, it's not often that we have experiences like this. And so they stick in our minds and our memories. And I like what Babbler had to say about how it has the idea of empathy, of understanding each other's differences. I have to say, I really like the use of the word tarmac and putting this mundane ethereal, mundane and ethereal together is such a wonderful juxtaposition that really captures how this is both spiritual and down to earth at the same time. So beautifully written and very well done.
Thank you.
And yeah, that's exactly the thumbtack that I had put in this one, Pam. The mundane ethereal tarmac cross in the desert. I love that little nugget in this poem. What I liked most also, Tink, is when you were about to start this one, you said, I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember this exact experience.
Yeah.
And a lot of my stuff has exactly that. I think almost every single one of my poems has some kind of triggered meaning or triggered experience that I expand upon and make either fantastic or true. We highlighted a poet a couple weeks ago in which I kept getting S sharp, in which he takes his prompts from just things he sees and then uses his creativity to make it feel very autobiographical. Mm-hmm. Do you find that a lot of your work is indeed more truly about your experiences, or do you find it's also a mixture of just pure creativity?
No, I have no imagination whatsoever. All my poems are life, I don't have the feeling that I make anything up, if I can explain it like that.
No, and that works. And I think that works because I get that. Because I think if the goal in poetry for some, at least for me, is to express or pinpoint an emotion, that I feel like I had to experience it myself first to be real with it. So, yeah, I think I'm the exact same way in that regard. Everything that I do is it's not out of a creative vein. It's more of just expanding upon my own experiences. So I like that. I like that this, especially this one, was such a simple interaction, seeing a shack in Arizona, which, to fill you in, Arizona is nothing but just a series of shacks, Tank. So you didn't see anything that was there. But
no. I'm sorry. I'm going to stand up for Arizona here. It is the most fantastic place. I would live there if I could.
but it's cool that you saw something that many people would just, hit the accelerator and drive on by, and you had an experience which obviously still sticks with you to this day. And you can remind us that finding those experiences is where all the magic lives. So I appreciate this poem for that.
Thank you. Can I read now, not the next poem on my list, but I've got two that I'd like to read back to back.
Sure.
One's called Kitchen Illustration.
Yes. I'm glad you're doing that one. Okay.
And the next one I'll read immediately afterwards is Kettles I Have Known. They both fit together, and they're not worth talking about separately, but I quite like them.
Okay. I can post them both.
That's great. Thank you.
And you can go ahead and start with Kitchen, and I'll get Kettles up right behind it. Go ahead.
So Kitchen Illustration. Well, as it reads, is kitchen our last ration, and I think you'll see why. A kitchen witch, a double sunk, brassed off, swivel brain trapped, pan fried, mouth ajar. Frigid, iced, and compartmentalized, I said, refridge irate. Swing, beam, full of rubbish. Dish, deviled, washed up, occasionally counterbalanced. Table for weighing condiments. Mint, meat, or twisted speech. There are books listing fine ingredients. Simpering sandwiches, tooted fruits, iced dreams, curdled these, clotted those. Source ages of wrapped thin intestinal membrane. Recipes, poems of a cook's life. Rhymes unseasoned. Take the chair and unite the kitchen cacophony. Black, rum, or scream with your coffee. And the next one is Kettles I Have Known. Not all kettles are the same. Some shout, toot their brains out. Others simmer to a boil, steam the kitchen walls to a crying drench, quietly evaporate and scold themselves out of existence. Others sit decoratively brass, a vintage prize on the Argo, eventually grease-splattered uselessly, pretty, unable, need borrowed heat. Electric tethered, unplugged, never. No thermostat heat releases their temper, and a mouse chewed through the cable. The latest, slickest kettle of all time is now mine. It practically talks. I have conversations about specific temperatures for oolong, tea leaves, black gunpowder, never boil for coffee, needs 100 degrees for rooibos and Thai teas. End poem.
I love that pairing. Pam, you get to dive in first.
All right. Yes, I think it was a wonderful choice to read these together. Though I do think they're both worthy to be commented on separately, it made sense definitely to put them together. With the first one, I really enjoy and appreciate the wordplay. With the second one, you know, the topic of tea kettles, I mean, it's such a, you feel like whatever tea kettle or kettles a person chooses really reflects on their personality and how they choose to represent themselves. And in fact, you know, the whole idea, I think, I really am really obsessed with the idea of people writing about their kitchen, writing about their china patterns or whatever it is that represents them, because we spend so much of our life in the kitchen, even if we don't cook, even if it's just to, you know, make tea, make coffee, you know, sit down and have some ice cream or whatever treat is our favorite. I love the darkness in this, the visceral imagery. There are books listing fine ingredients, sandwiches, curdled beef, clotted those, sausages of warped thin intestinal membranes. I mean, that is just... that is clever and fun, dark and witty, you know. And I like how there's this, you know, almost like a whole acknowledging your obsession with the, I don't know if it's an obsession, but the idea of that inner dialogue about what's right for which kind of tea. And the conversations had between yourself and the tea kettle. this is a great rites and very well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, I totally agree, Pam. And I didn't catch, when I was reading Kitchen Illustration, I didn't catch it at the very first time that's what you were trying to do with the title. And then I got halfway through the poem and I went, wait a minute, Pink's messing with me. I got to start over and make sure I'm catching everything she's pitching on this one. And then you and I have talked through the comments on kettles before, but I want to give you an opportunity just to expand a little bit, Tank. What are these two, and why did you pair them together? And give us some more insight on what you have going on with these.
I'm a mother. I'm a wife. I spend too much time in the kitchen over my years. I'm no longer, my kids have moved away, but there's that thing about being at home and being the factotum almost. I only had sons and I try to teach them how to behave properly, but somehow it never worked for me. So I've got that kind of anger, pent up anger about all my time in the kitchen. So I think Kitchen Illustration was a little bit of a vent. And the kettle one was just fun, really. But I do think what Pam said about the choices that we make, particularly about that we live within our kitchens, says so much about us. That's more or less where those two are coming from. And I think they sit together. I wanted them to be seen as a pair, really.
No, and they are, and it works. I'm glad you pointed that out and read them together. I think a lot of the joy of writing really comes through, like very much so about what we were talking about earlier with Babbler's work. And how much fun she had in writing some of her poems. I felt that same way in what you put together in these. How much playfulness, how much wittiness, and when you're hearing them be performed, all I'm doing is smiling. So great stuff. Babbler, your comments.
Well, I really enjoyed these. I think of the two, I had the most fun with Kitchen Illustration. The wordplay is phenomenal, to make near homophone from words that aren't related necessarily what you're saying, but still paint a picture, and to have a message in there, about just being burnt out in the kitchen. It almost, there's sexism in there, a kitchened witch, a double-sunk brassed-off swivel, brain-trapped, pan-fried mouth ajar, just being kind of limited to this kitchen, frigid, iced, and compartmental, I said, like I'm stuck in here, refrige irate, like I don't want to, I picture someone like slamming cupboards around, like, sure, I'll make your stupid dinner, but it's a little more fun than that. It's like, it's almost like Fantasia meets Angry Housewife. And I really enjoyed it. And I don't know why the simple phrase, the tooted fruits, was so enjoyable for me. But I particularly like tooted fruits. I love it, though. It's a beautiful mixture of anger and venting and joy all at once. There's humor and a message and wordplay. I think it's beautifully complex and enjoyable. The other one is also good fun, although all the descriptions of the kettles, and it almost feels like when I read the title, Kettles I Have Known, I think of, the phrase of like the pot calling the kettle black, and a comparison, and it's like, if I were a kettle, what kind of kettle would I be? Am I useless? Like, how useful am I? It's just kind of fun, because it's kind of a cataloging of actual kettles. But I think it also says something about usefulness and purpose. And I also like the end again is a word play, typhoon tease, T tease being like, you know, to tease you with it instead of like the actual tease. again, it's fun, but there's also a little message tucked in there. And I just enjoyed the cataloging of kettles with opinions. So, wonderful night.
Thank you.
And thank you both for a wonderful evening. Again, very much like Babbler, we weren't able to get through all of T. Ink Poem's set list for the evening, so you can always check the show link if you want to read the rest of the poems that she has selected to share with us tonight. Or, of course, you can read her entire body of work here on All Poetry at any time just by clicking her name. I want to thank our two highlighters tonight, Babbler, T. Ink Poem. You guys are both a heck of a lot of fun. I always enjoy reading your work, and I recommend that everyone else dives in to take a deeper look because you both are extremely talented and quite a joy. Thank you very much for joining me tonight on the show.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's very enjoyable being here.
And, of course, thanks to my co-host, Pam Ray. We will be at it again next week with Otterberg, and the second headliner has yet to be announced, so stay tuned, everyone. But thank you again for two headliners tonight, and see you guys again next week. Good night.
Night.